This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, a battle among labor unions? But infighting is so unlike the left. We'll tell you about a schism forming over a hot-button issue later on.
I've never fought with anybody else on the left in my life. Also, President Obama has charged more people with espionage than any other president in history, combined. And now he's adding to his total. That story in a classified session.
Maybe we can check out some intelligence reports about whether or not you actually have fought with people on the left, because I'm not so sure about that.
And I did it this morning.
And finally, who says the class war isn't about fun and games? We'll be talking about the radical history of board games with Brian Van Slyke. He's the co-founder of the TISA Collective and author of a recent article on the subject.
I'm really, really looking forward to this.
Yeah.
We're going to somehow work Civilization VI into this conversation. I know it.
I predict that will happen.
But first, when Randy on Twitter made a joke last week about working at a post office in Ohio and destroying Trump absentee ballots. Mind you, Randy doesn't work at a post office and he doesn't even live in Ohio. But when Randy did that on Twitter, it showed what happens when weird Twitter cuts into this weird as hell election. I keep saying Randy. I suppose I should refer to him by his Twitter handle, at Randy G-Dub. But just one tweet from Randy. One irony tweet shook the country. His 140-character missive was picked up in the right-wing blogosphere, appeared on the Drudge Report, was talked about by Rush Limbaugh, was addressed on MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes. We talked about it on our show because it was funny as hell. Anyway, the stakes of what people say on Twitter are already a bit too high in some cases. As we see when it comes to Randy. But the thing about it is they're about to be raised even further. And for that story, let's step inside a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Okay, so The Intercept is reporting that as soon as December of this year, Customs and Border Protection in the U.S. may soon be asking certain foreign travelers to the U.S. to submit information about their social media accounts. What's their Facebook name, their Twitter handle? I wonder if your Tinder profile counts. I wonder if they're interested in that. Determine thirst levels of our travel of our visitors to the country. Anyway, earlier this year, the agency formally proposed the new regulation. It was basically a request to add an additional line on the visa waiver application, a line that reads, quote, please enter information associated with your online presence, provider platform, social media, identifier.
Please don't at me, U.S. government.
Now, this would apply to all individuals traveling to the U.S. under the visa waiver program, referring to those who live in 38 countries, mostly in Europe. It allows travelers from those countries to come to the U.S. once their application is approved without having to obtain a visa. Hence why it's called the Visa Waiver Program. So CBP, Customs and Border Protection, wants to inquire about people's social media moving forward. The rule, it's already gone through the public comment period. And now it's just waiting final approval by the Office of Management and Budget, and they have 60 days to approve it or not. So, you know, as The Intercept noted, this could be taking effect by the end of the year, 60 days from now. Now, here's the key part. CBP has proposed adding this extra question, but the agency said that it would be optional. People won't have to provide their social media accounts. It's just an optional thing that bit of information to provide when considering the visa waiver application. But a CBP spokesperson speaking to The Intercept said, quote, did not say whether leaving social media information off an application would adversely impact someone's visa waiver application or flag them for extra screening, saying only that the application could still be submitted without it. This is optional, But we're not being told whether or not if you were to decide not to fill in your social media information, whether that would adversely affect your chances of having your application accepted and being allowed into the U.S. Now, let's just take a second and think about the utility of this new inquiry for people's social media accounts. If it's an optional question, then people who might regularly promote bad stuff, I don't know, you know, ISIS videos, talk about committing terrorism or whatever, someone who the U.S. government might have qualms about letting into the country, I doubt that they'll be sharing their social media accounts on the application.
Oh, yeah, just follow me on Twitter. I'm at ISISRules420.
I mean, some people might, sure, but look.
Just follow me. I'm 9/11 was good on Instagram.
So, plus, if someone is posting this sort of stuff on their social media, if they do have an account like ISIS for Life 420 or whatever, I'm sure you'll be able to find out that they're a pretty unsavory character in other ways besides just monitoring their social media accounts. There are already pretty thorough inspections. Now, if this does eventually become a requirement, or if not filling out the social media field adversely affects someone's chances of getting accepted and allowed into the U.S., well, then that's problematic for a whole host of other reasons, many of which were noted during that public comment period against the rule. Number one, privacy, free speech, free association. That's why this is problematic. Digital rights group Access Now warned that such a rule could chill online speech and expression. The group noted, quote, social media handles can easily lead the government to information about a traveler's political leanings, religious affiliations, reading habits, purchase histories, dating preferences, and sexual orientations, among other things. Moreover, given the highly networked nature of social media, the government would also learn such personal details about travelers' family, friends, professional colleagues, and other innocent associates, many of whom may be U.S. citizens and/or residents with constitutional and statutory rights. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, another digital rights advocacy group, further added in a web post against the proposal, quote, travelers accustomed to political repression in their own countries may inhibit their own expression to avoid scrutiny during anticipated future travel. So too will Americans, knowing that an international friend's decision to answer CBP's proposed question could compromise our own opportunity for anonymous speech as well as associations. And that gets a bit to the whole two hops thing that we learned from the whole NSA debate, that when surveillance or the government has a particular target or they're reviewing a certain target, they're allowed to take two hops from that target. So not just the target, but everybody in that target's buddy list or email inbox, and then everybody in their buddy list or email inbox. So if it's an international friend, your social media contacts could end up being monitored by CBP. And we know how the government likes to share things. Even the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, he's uncomfortable about the CBP inquiring about people's social media presence. He wrote a letter to the U.S. ambassador to the UN in September. And he was concerned about that the rule could lead to citizens of other countries suppressing their speech out of fear they may be denied entry to the U.S. Not exactly the role the U.S. sees itself playing as a force that causes people to suppress their online speech. So a lot of people are aware of this pending rule. They're concerned about it from both a constitutional perspective and a moral one. But there's another reason why this is a problem, and this gets back to our boy Randy on Twitter. Assuming CBP starts actively relying on people's social media accounts in the future to do vetting, it's just going to add to the volumes of information that the border agency is already combing through and other government agencies are already combing through to determine who is and who isn't a threat. In other words, you're just making the haystack bigger that you need to find the needle in. And Twitter, look, Twitter is probably the worst sort of information to rely on when vetting people. I mean, what if some Frenchman who really likes weird Twitter said something along the lines of what Randy said about the post office? If they just went on an irony rant or something, do we trust Border Patrol agents to get the joke? To get that this was just a thing on weird Twitter, that this isn't an actual threat?
Nope.
I don't get them. I don't think they will get it. I don't trust them to. I can't think of a better way to obscure CBP's picture of the whole situation than by dumping in a bunch of Twitter data into its systems. You'll get a lot of weird Turkish nationalist fervor. A lot of irony about ISIS. Stuff that, to an untrained eye, might raise a lot of red flags. People might think there's some weird stuff going on here. But stuff that's ultimately 100% completely meaningless. As someone who spends a lot of time on weird Twitter, I assure you, the vast majority of it is mostly meaningless. Nathan White, with Access Now, told The Intercept that their group is one of many pressuring the Office of Management and Budget to shoot down the proposed rule. He said, quote, to the OMB, we're making the argument that it's expensive to collect this and it's useless. Only innocent people are going to give you their real information. We'll keep you posted on this, but don't scrub your Twitter accounts just yet.
I got to be honest with you. I really, right now, I want to file a FOIA request with DHS, with CBP, with the FBI, with all sorts of intelligence and law enforcement agencies and ask them, how are they dealing with irony? How are they dealing with the dozens of accounts who go online to say, actually, ISIS is good?
Yeah, like understanding irony on Twitter takes some training. You know, it takes some skill. It's like learning a different language almost. You got to spend a lot of time in it to understand it. And a CBP agent just getting someone's Twitter profile, logging into it and looking through it might not be able to get the nuance that so often exists. All right. Also, on to another story coming across our classified session wires here on Monday. We've got another espionage charge coming down from the Department of Justice from President Obama. At the end of last week, the Washington Post reported that Harold T. Martin III, the NSA's most notorious hoarder, will be charged with violating the Espionage Act, a 100-year-old law intended for traitors, but has also been used by the Obama administration against journalist sources and leakers. President Obama has used the Espionage Act more time than any other presidential administration in history combined. Add up all the presidents in history, how many times they've used the Espionage Act to go after leaker, journalist source, or whatever. President Obama's done it more times. It was revealed earlier this month that Harold Martin was arrested after federal agents discovered mountains of classified information stored in his home, in his car, in sheds in his backyard. Documents, digital material that Martin had allegedly removed from his workplace without authorization. Washington Post reported that agents say Martin took at least 50 terabytes, not gigabytes, terabytes of data, and quote, six full banker's boxes worth of documents, with many lying open in his home office or kept on his car's back seat and in the trunk. As I said, other material was stored in a shed on his property. Kind of give you some perspective on a terabyte. 1 terabyte of information is equivalent of 500 hours worth of movies. A lot of movies.
Got the popcorn?
Yeah. And Martin took 50 terabytes, so a lot. 50 times 500. You can do the math. He also took personal information about government employees, as well as dozens of computers, thumb drives, and other digital storage devices. What the hell was the NSA doing? This was a Booz Allen contractor, by the way, again. Government alleges that Martin was able to defeat a myriad of expensive controls placed on classified information. sure how expensive they were if this guy was able to make off with 50 terabytes of papers, computers, digital storage devices. Well, government said that the devices seized showed that Martin made extensive use of sophisticated encryption. He also used a sophisticated software tool that runs without being installed on a computer and provides anonymous internet access, thus leaving no digital footprint on the machine. His hoarding, Mr. Martin's hoarding, investigators believe, go back to 1996. He was working with the Navy Reserves and had access to classified information. This guy's been doing this for 20 years. Remember the whole insider threat stuff that came up after Snowden? This guy was doing that throughout that as well.
Well, allegedly.
Allegedly, yes. So far, the government does not believe Martin passed any information onto foreign agents. Despite that, though, they're preparing espionage charges and have deemed him a flight risk, warning that Martin may still reveal top secret information to adversaries. There's also this interesting tidbit. Investigators say that Martin is the prime suspect in the Shadow Brokers hack. That was back in August when a bunch of digital hacking tools that reportedly belonged to the NSA, tools that the NSA used to hack into other computers, well, they were placed online. These top secret tools were put online up for auction somehow. Washington Post reported that although investigators have not found conclusive evidence that Martin was responsible for the Shadow Brokers hack, he is the prime suspect. U.S. officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the investigation is ongoing and that it was that event, the Shadow Brokers event, that set off the search that ended up leading authorities to Martin. Some secret news there to kick off the week. More unanimous dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C.
So most of our listeners have probably at one point in their lives played Monopoly. I think that's safe to assume. Sam, what piece did you like to play as Monopoly? Top hat, race car, dog?
I did like the race car most of the time.
Yeah, that was me.
As I got older, though, I liked the thimble because of how absurd it was.
True, true.
Yeah.
So we all know how the game usually ends, with one or perhaps multiple people quitting in disgust with no viable shot of ending up on top, usually storming off, perhaps knocking the board onto the floor. Perhaps there are a few swear words interspersed.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Now, if that kind of sounds like capitalism in real life, that's because it's supposed to. Monopoly has its roots in radical socialist thought. Joining us now to discuss this and the illustrious left-wing history of board games is Brian Van Slyke, the co-founder of the TISA Collective, which is a worker co-op that develops resources for social and economic change, including a game called Coopoly, which, as I understand it, is kind of like Monopoly, but for cooperatives. And as a member of a news co-op, the host of the show can get behind that.
We sure can.
Brian also recently wrote about this subject for truthout.org in a piece called The Secret History of Leftist Board Games. Welcome, Brian. It's good to have you. We're excited to talk about this.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
So in your piece last week, you noted Monopoly itself wasn't created by a leftist, but there was a similar game, a very similar game that came before Monopoly that was created as kind of a socialist propaganda. And, you know, I say that lovingly, the propaganda. What's the backstory here?
Yeah, so, you know, the common story or the common attribution is that Monopoly was created by this fellow named Charles Darrow during the Great Depression. And it was people just really like this idea of holding on to like physical money when they didn't actually have a lot of real money. And it was sort of this like way for people to escape and feel like they might be rich even during this time of economic turmoil. But it turns out that that's not true at all. The real origins of Monopoly goes back about three decades earlier to the early 1900s when a Quaker socialist woman named Elizabeth Maggie invented a game called the Landlord's Game. And so the Landlord's Game is pretty much the same thing as Monopoly. Monopoly is a ripoff of the Landlord's Game with a couple little tweaks here and there. But the point of the Landlord's Game was to sort of demonstrate to players how awful land grabbing and wealth, you know, consolidation is. And it actually had two sets of rules. One was a sort of a socialist utopia version, and one was the version we know today called Monopoly. And Elizabeth Maggie created it to play with people and children, have them sort of experience the two different economic philosophies. They could play one Monopoly version and then the sort of the more socialist version. And it was actually for quite some time an underground hit, especially in sort of left-wing academic activist and also Quaker communities, especially around Atlantic City. And what ended up happening was, you know, she kept trying to sell it to game companies. They even set up their own game company called the Economic Game Company, yeah, and trying to popularize it. But it never really took off until 30 years later, Charles Darrow took this game that he had played. A lot of people ended up actually also making their own copies of the game in their homes, and that kind of stuff is really this like underground thing. And he ended up taking this version of it and tweaked it a little bit and sold it to a game company. And they, you know, and then it became very popular when it was framed as a very pro-Monopoly game.
It's funny. It's a pro-Monopoly game because, you know, like I said, it usually leads to fights and acrimony. And
yeah, which makes this whole thing funny because board games by nature are competitive. You're trying to beat someone. I guess there's other games like cooperative games like Pandemic or something where you're working with people to defeat a virus or something. But most board games are competitive. You're trying to win, which fits very well with capitalism and trying to create all the money. It's as though this people are drawing the wrong messages from this game that was supposed to show the evils of capitalism, but instead people play to feel like a capitalist.
Yep. Maggie has this quote where she says, "Let the children once see clearly the gross injustice of our present land system, and when they grow up, if they are allowed to develop naturally, the evil will soon be remedied." And that was her sort of vision for Monopoly. It didn't quite work out that way, unfortunately, but it's interesting, though, because when the game was framed as an anti-Monopoly game, as an anti-capitalist game, it still was a popular game, right? But it was this underground game. It just didn't have any major company backing. It didn't have this way to get out to the masses. But once it was framed as a pro-Monopoly game, then this, you know, major game company was able to take it and was able to, you know, put it out into the masses. And so it's interesting when you look at it, it's sort of the framing of the game and then how people respond to it that way.
So what do you do with Coopoly that keeps the, I guess, fun of trying to take everybody's money or at least win the game, but also instill kind of cooperative values?
Yeah, so Coopoly is actually, you mentioned Pandemic earlier. Coopoly is a cooperative game, and that means a game where everyone wins or everyone loses together. And this is sort of like a game subgenre that is getting much more popular these days. And Coopoly, so everyone wins or everyone loses together. It's basically the players playing against the game itself. And so the game system is its own player, and then everyone else are working together to try to beat the game. And so in Coopoly, you play as a cooperative. You come up with the cooperative that you want to play as. It can be like totally serious, like a news go up, or it can be totally fictional, like a art school for dragons or whatever, or a news co-op for dragons, whatever you want. But the game teases out the story as you go. It's funny that the gameplay actually isn't like Monopoly at all. It just sort of was a easy way to frame. But yeah,
a hook, some way to let the users know that the players know that this is a board game like Monopoly,
right,
but not like Monopoly because it's cooperating, right, not trying to build a one-man cartel.
Right.
I want to talk about a little more about some of the other games that you mentioned in your piece, because some of them are pretty fascinating. There was Elizabeth Maggie. You noted that other women created educational, politically conscious games, and that one of them was about women gaining the right to vote. What's the story behind Suffragetto?
Yeah, that's a super interesting game. It was created, there's a little bit of debate, but most likely in 1909. The game is super interesting in its content, because I actually think that if the game came out today, it would be like super controversial. But it's about women battling police, and the women are trying to get to the House of Commons. It's a British game. Yeah. The women are trying to battle police to get to the House of Commons to interrupt a politician's speech who's most likely is against the suffragette movement. And so that's the goal of the game, is your suffragettes fighting the cops and trying to interrupt this speech. And so it's a two-player game. One player takes on the role of the police, and one player takes on the role of the suffragettes. And so they're sort of battling. It's kind of like chess or checkers, and it's like, you know, you move a piece, jump over stuff, and that kind of gameplay. But it's super radical for its time, and I honestly, if it came out today, I think people would be it would stir up a lot of controversy as well if it was on a current topic.
Yeah, I noticed, because as you describe in your piece, when a cop sort of jumps a suffragette, they go to jail, but when a suffragette jumps over a cop, they end up in a hospital. Which seems, you know, like something that
the Blue Lives Matter folks would like too much.
Yeah, the corporate distributors, you know, Target, Walmart, et cetera.
Yeah,
I'm sure they would go absolutely bonkers with that. But you also noted, by the way, for anyone listening, and there's a link to this on your piece, that anyone who wants to play suffragetto. Not sure which way it's pronounced, but anyone who wants to play can print it out and actually play it. So if you want to play this board game where you can attack cops, you can do it online.
It's subversive. It's good.
And very subversive. And speaking of subversive, there was another game that came out in the late 70s, a more modern game. Now, this one seems like one that I want to have beers and play right now. And it's something based on something as old as history. What's the deal with the game Class Struggle?
So Class Struggle is a super interesting game. It came out in 1978, and it was by this professor of politics at New York University, Bertel Ohlman, still around, still teaching. Actually, has a lot of books in print and that kind of stuff. But he made this game called Class Struggle, where it pitted workers against capitalists. And literally at the start of the game, you roll the dice to find out if you're a capitalist or or a worker. It's sort of like the roll of the genetic dice is what the game says. So you don't get to decide. And then the game is battling, not quite battling the same way as Suffragetto, but it's battling in sort of a more traditional roll the dice, move your piece, land on spaces type of things. And there's so many, like, it's from 1978. Some of the content is a little bit outdated. But it also is sort of like a really interesting time capsule, but of sort of political thought at the time. But it's amazing because it actually was fairly successful as far as board games go, in that it had a first print run of 5,000 copies. The game wasn't like an instant hit. They were racking up dust, and then a news article like latched onto it. You know, talked about it. It stirred up some controversy, and so it kind of exploded from there. I kind of think of it sort of as like a, you know, even though hipsters weren't around in 1978, I think there are a lot of people who are playing it as a sort of ironic way. But it also became very popular amongst socialists and leftists and that kind of stuff. And at the end of the role of the game is for the workers to become liberated, or the capitalists win by starting nuclear war. It's like, you know, like I said, some of the things are a little bit outdated, but it's also a game. It's also a game. It's playful. Yeah. And so I think it went out of print in 1994. You can still find copies. I have a copy. You can get one on Amazon, but it's a really interesting game because you can like set up trade unions as the workers. You can, you know, build alliances with farmers. Capitalists can try to hinder workers by pitting them against each other, giving them debits, all these sorts of things. Yeah, it's if it were to be reprinted, it would need a little bit of updating. But it's also just a fascinating sort of story of how its second printing actually they went from 5,000 copies to 25,000 copies.
Wow.
And, you know, it was being distributed all around the world, being put in bookstores and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's interesting that the person who created Bertell Ullman didn't really make any money off of it. There was a lot of hard business lessons about for this person building a socialist game. A lot of mistakes were made and that kind of stuff. But it really definitely reached a lot of people and a lot of people were able to use it in education classes at homes and talking about socialism and Marxism in a way that they had never done before.
Well, it might not need that much updating. We've got historic levels of inequality and Donald Trump dangerously close to the White House. And we know how reckless he's been talking about nuclear weapons. Let's talk about video games. Sam and I have been really giddy lately about the new release of Civilization VI, which is not the most socially conscious game. It's just about building empire and waging war. I guess there's something about educating people in science and stuff like that, but mostly it's war and empire. You say in your piece that there's a small but growing tradition of socially conscious video games. You note that even Sonic the Hedgehog was originally created with an environmental message. What are some examples of left-wing politics creeping into video games or some video games with overt radical political messages? Just about in the last minute we have left here, Brian.
Yeah, one of my favorite is This War of Mine. It's a PC game where you're not fighting in a war, but you're civilians trying to survive it. And the game isn't fun. It's gripping and it's devastating. And it really puts war and violence in a perspective I've never seen before in a video game. And I really recommend it to people who want to look at alternatives to how war and violence is portrayed in games. I think it's one of the best recent examples of left-wing politics creeping into video games.
Well, that's certainly different from Civ, where you can nuke other empires without much consequence. I don't know. Yeah.
Does remind me a little bit of Oregon Trail, where bad things would happen to you, and it did show hardships back in the day.
And I never played Fallout, but doesn't that start with like nuclear apocalypse?
Yeah, but that's just kind of like the background of the whole game. Sorry, we got 30 seconds left. Tell us real quick about TESA Co-op, TESA Co-op.
Yeah, TESA creates resources for social and economic change. And one of the things we do is create games like Coopoly. Our newest game, Rise Up, the Game of People in Power, is a game about building an activist movement. And it's actually on Kickstarter right now. We're trying to fundraise to get it published. But yeah, we create tools for your cause.
So that is Toolbox for Ed is the Twitter name, @ToolboxForEd, if you want to follow the TESA Collective. And Brian, what is your Twitter handle if our listeners want to follow you?
I am equally as hard to hear out loud. I am @TheBrinos, BRINOS.
Okay. Well, nice. Brian Van Slyke, co-founder of the TESA Collective, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was great to chat with you.
You too. More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com, a fine website.
Fine website, indeed. So late last week, WikiLeaks tweeted that it had, quote, a surprise in store for Tim Kaine and Donna Brazile. The latter is the interim chair of the Democratic National Committee. The former, of course, is Hillary Clinton's vice presidential candidate. As of this recording, we're still not sure what that is or what that surprise will be.
And it could be nothing, considering that WikiLeaks often teases big things that don't turn out to be big things. But
yes, but there are some other interesting unknowns about Kaine that we can discuss, namely who will fill his Senate seat if the Democrats retain the White House in November. Something, as we've noted, seems increasingly likely with the wheels completely falling off the Donald Trump campaign.
I'll throw my name in for consideration.
Well, okay, you've got that. You've got that. So my co-host here, Sam Sachs, is now officially...
I don't need it. I don't need to do this, but if the people are calling for me, I'll do it.
Well, I was going to ask you if you were about to form an exploratory committee or set up, some sort of campaign structure, but that won't be necessary because Kane's replacement is going to be picked by Virginia's governor. On Friday, The Hill noted who is on that short list. A substitution, as I said, will be made by Terry McAuliffe.
If McAuliffe is anything like McDonald, I think I know a way I can get in there.
Were you thinking Porsches, Ferraris?
Yeah, watches, you know.
All that good stuff. Anyway, the names on the actual shortlist, not Sam Sachs, include Virginia's three Democratic congressmen, Bobby Scott, Don Beyer, and Jerry Connolly. State legislator Jennifer McClellan has also been touted as a possible replacement. In July, McAuliffe hinted that he was leaning toward either Scott or McClellan, who are both African-American. I want a diverse congressional delegation, no question in my mind, is what McAuliffe said. The Hill remarked on Friday that Scott was in fact the clear favorite, leading a poll with a plurality, beating both Beyer and Connolly. Although McClellan was not included in the poll. If chosen by McAuliffe, Scott would be Virginia's first black U.S. senator, and McClellan would be both the first woman and the first African-American to represent Virginia's Senate delegation. Whoever is tapped for the gig, however, can expect an unusually tough time defending their position. McAuliffe's appointee will have to run again in November 2017, a term which will only last for 1 year, because the seat that Kane now occupies is up for grabs in November 2018, which, by the way, is shaping up to be a tough midterm schedule for Senate Democrats. I think they have like 28 seats to defend.
Yikes.
And by the way, as the Associated Press noted in the summer, Virginia's next gubernatorial election is also scheduled for 2017, next year. So that and the Senate contest will make the state the political epicenter of the country. So if you're having election withdrawal, if you miss all the horse race crap, focus your eyes on Old Dominion. The Commonwealth is where it's at. One political analyst told the AP that political spending in Virginia next year easily surpassed $100 million.
Damn, that's a lot of cash.
I'm making it rain.
He is. Speaking of cash, let's hit up some economic news for the 99%.
Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street!
The issue of forced arbitration in employee contracts is getting some attention on Capitol Hill, and testifying on the matter is someone you wouldn't expect, a former Fox News anchor, Gretchen Carlson. Carlson left Fox News after going public with accusations of sexual harassment against the station's head honcho, Roger Ailes, because she and others who work at Fox News had to sign forced arbitration contracts. Fox alleged that Carlson couldn't sue the company, that the matter would have to be worked out behind closed doors instead. But when the saga was publicized, Fox eventually just gave Carlson $20 million and Ailes stepped down. But the same thing is currently happening with Andrea Tanteros, another Fox personality who has alleged harassment. She's being pressured to handle the matter in arbitration instead of getting her day in court. That's the problem with these forced arbitration clauses. It doesn't allow employees to sue their employers. In a profile in Time magazine, Carlson said about forced arbitration, quote, "A lot of people that I've heard from about being unfairly dismissed find themselves in the middle of either legal action or, more likely, forced arbitration. It is a huge problem because it's secret, and it plays into why we think that we've come so far in society and we probably really haven't because we don't hear about it." Well, Gretchen Carlson is slated to testify, as I said, on Capitol Hill soon related to legislation that would prohibit forced arbitration in employment contracts. Stay tuned for that hearing, probably next year, I would guess, in the next session of Congress.
Did they mention which committee?
No, but it is sponsored by Senators Leahy and Frank in the legislation.
Judiciary, maybe.
Yeah, it could be judiciary.
Yeah.
Now time for a look at some environmental news in a segment we call the Sludge Report.
Oil oil spill stretching for miles.
A torrent of methane gas is spewing into the air.
The Sludge Report.
Just realized that was a bit of a silly question. Of course, an issue forced arbitration and courts would be the Judiciary Committee. So I apologize for that. We start our Sludge Report with an update on events surrounding the Dakota Access Pipeline. Tension last week turned briefly neither to plans to build the oil pumping vessel itself, nor protests surrounding said plans, but to journalists' right to cover those demonstrations. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman appeared last week in a North Dakota state court to face charges of participating in a riot. Yeah, and those were filed after previous charges of criminal trespassing were dropped the week before by prosecutors. But Judge John Grinsteiner rejected the riot indictment, refusing to sign off on it, thus acquitting Goodman of the allegations. She had faced up to 30 days in jail and a $1,500 fine.
I think the judge made the right decision there.
Ditto.
This could have turned into a really, really bad situation.
I agree.
I mean, it's still a bad situation, yeah. Of course, but God.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Goodman said after the acquittal that I wasn't trespassing, I wasn't rioting. The Democracy Now! Team and I were there to report, to document what was happening on the ground. And she added that the case brought against her amounted to, quote, simply a threat to all journalists around the country. Do not come to North Dakota.
Noted.
Lad Erickson, the state prosecutor who sought to throw the book at Goodman, disagrees, obviously. She's a protester, basically, is what he said before the acquittal. Everything she reported on was from the position of justifying the protest actions. As Matt Taibbi noted in an October 13th piece on the case, the message here is chilling. A prosecutor who arrests a reporter because he doesn't think she's balanced enough is basically telling future reporters what needs to be in their stories to avoid arrest. Hitting the nail on the head there, Matt.
Yes.
I agree. Goodman was charged just days after a September 3rd crackdown on protesters at a Dakota Access camp, one that saw private security guards sick attack dogs on demonstrators. Another environmental journalist, however, is also in trouble in North Dakota, and she might not be as lucky as Goodman, who enjoys worldwide recognition for her two decades of work with Democracy Now!, celebrated progressive news show, celebrated its 20th anniversary earlier this year.
Happy birthday.
Belated congratulations. Love Democracy Now! Very good program. Documentary producer Dia Schlossberg still faces three felony conspiracy charges for filming Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline protests on October 11th at a site in North Dakota's Pembina County. Apologize if it's actually pronounced Pembina or something. Apologies to the residents of the county.
Who are listening to the show. We hear you in North Dakota.
Hanging on my every word. Prosecutors are alleging that Schlossberg was, quote, recruited to record the criminal activity for the documentary project, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change.
Real sounds like a real threatening documentary there, huh?
Yeah, and speaking of political prisoners and or people targeted for political activity, Edward Snowden tweeted support for the producer, noting that Schlossberg faces 45 years in jail, while, quote, for a reference, I face a mere 30 years. You know you're in trouble when you're getting sympathy from Edward Snowden.
Yeah.
And whose indictment, by the way, includes the Espionage Act. Schlossberg's attorneys hit out at prosecutors saying, quote, I was surprised at the conspiracy charges. I never thought that would ever happen. All she was doing was her job of being a journalist and covering the story. Attorneys for the state claim that Schlossberg came to North Dakota with demonstrators to, quote, with the objective of diverting the flow of oil. That's
with her camera.
I guess so.
Well, if you lay enough cameras in the pipe, you can divert the flow of the oil.
You might ruin a few cameras, though.
True.
Know a few photographers who'd probably advise against that. Meanwhile, a fight is brewing on the left over the energy infrastructure project. Some unions are calling on President Obama to approve the Access Pipeline. The International Union of Operating Engineers, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the Labor's International Union of North America, United Association, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. All five called on the president to push forward with the project, which is currently stalled.
Felt a lot of camaraderie in those names there. A lot of brotherhoods.
A lot of fraternities.
Yeah.
Fraternal Anyway, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe sued the Obama administration to stop Dakota Access. A judge last month, rejected most of the tribe's motion, but the Army Corps of Engineers agreed to suspend the project for a review. The five aforementioned unions now are calling on that review to end. In a one-page letter, they wrote the following: the intervention by the Departments of Justice, Interior, and the U.S. Army to indefinitely hold a project that is more than halfway constructed and has received state and federal approval raises serious concerns about the future of infrastructure development in America and the livelihoods of our members. In a statement to NBC News, Standing Rock Sioux Chairman Dave Archambault II pointed out how there is no shortage of backing among labor unions for the tribe's struggle. He remarked how the anti-pipeline movement is being supported by the SEIU, CWA, National Nurses United, the Amalgamated Transit Union, and the American Postal Workers. "We stand together in peace and solidarity," Archambault said, "because this pipeline threatens the lives of more than 17 million people who rely on the Missouri River for their water."
I don't understand. Everybody's against this pipeline except, like, the companies that are building it.
I don't know. It's a dollar bill. What can we say? You know,
it's just depressing how, like, much effort has to go into fighting things that, like, the only people supporting this are the companies that are going to directly profit off of it.
Yeah. Well, it seems like state officials, certainly Republican state officials, at least. I don't know. Since the oil prices fell as well in North Dakota, I think officials there and economic planners there are a little more concerned with they used to have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, tell me about this Kansas gas cloud.
Yes. Finally, a small town in northeastern Kansas played host to a hazardous chemical spill late last week. County and local officials in the town of Atchison had temporarily ordered an evacuation after an accidental mixture of chemicals at a plant created a toxic cloud. That's the cloud you were asking about.
Yeah.
34 people were treated for minor respiratory problems as a result, Atchison City Manager Trey Cocking told the media. The cloud then dissipated. Atchison is a town of about 11,000 people, by the way, for those of you keeping score at home. The incident occurred at a plant owned and operated by MGP Ingredients Incorporated. Company makes food products, including rye whiskeys, gins, and vodkas. So let's hope their production line is back and running in no time. Am I right?
Yeah, just in time. No, the weekend's over. Just in time for Monday, the week to start.
Yep. Start off Monday with a whiskey neat, double, triple, who knows, whatever you got to do, man. According to a Kansas City Fox affiliate, the chemicals may have been sulfuric acid and chlorine, and the Atchison City Manager Cocking said the cloud was caused by an accident at the distillery when two chemicals, which he didn't name, were mistakenly mixed. So I haven't taken chemistry since I was 16 years old, so I don't know much about it, but I'm pretty sure that you don't want sulfuric acid and chlorine in your booze. If there's sulfuric acid and chlorine in your booze, you're going to have a bad time.
I can't remember anything from chemistry class, but yeah, I will attest to that.
I do know this, though. Johnny was a chemist's son, but Johnny is no more. For what he thought was H2O was H2SO4.
Nice. I also remember learning about moles.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I have no idea what they are now.
Wasn't it a mole was like the number of atoms that is in a certain amount of thing? Or...
I don't know. Now I just know mole. Mexican food.
Yeah. Well, I got to stop making fun of the STEM guys on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Because I, you know.
Send you a bomb. All right. Almost finished with today's show. We now leave you with a devil's advocate.
I agree with you, Bart.
What about both sides?
Well, you're only technically right.
Devil's advocate.
So at the end of last week, there was a major cyber attack against a number of internet infrastructure centers that affected access to hundreds of websites up and down the East Coast. New York Times, Spotify, Reddit, and most troubling, of course, Twitter, all experienced disruptions in service.
Looks like someone finally read your tweets.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest on Friday told reporters that the Department of Homeland Security was, quote, monitoring the situation and would, quote, take a close look at it. He called the actions malicious, but wouldn't speculate on who might be responsible. We're aware and are investigating all potential causes, the Department of Homeland Security later told Politico. Now, of course, we don't condone any of these sort of cyber attacks. This is bad, obviously, especially when they take down websites like Twitter. But in a way, it's also kind of good, because while Twitter was down, Sam and I engage in all of these fresh new things that we would have absolutely missed out on otherwise.
Yeah, instead of trolling Jonathan Chait online and tweeting about what a hack he is, I just went to his house and took a shit on his front porch. I didn't.
Yeah, good stuff like that.
Prove it, though. Prove it.
Prove I didn't.
Test it. Test the turd. DNA test that turd.
Instead of desperately hitting refresh on my Menchies over and over again for hours, I went and played basketball with a bunch of middle schoolers, and I beat the snot out of them. I owned them. I was dominant in the paint underneath the basket, those little kids.
Yeah, well, I'd hope so. You got about a foot and a half on them.
Yeah.
And instead of playing Pokemon Go, I went in the alley to catch raccoons and possums.
Oh, there you go.
I think I might have three different kinds of rabies, but boy, was it good exercise.
Yes. And instead of tweeting consumer complaints incessantly at various companies, I picked up an actual phone and called them. And I've been on hold ever since. What fun, everybody. What fun.
That doesn't sound like it was actually good.
No, it's bad. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C., so you don't have to be.